Mike Malevsky here in Crystal River, Florida, on a moderately warm day with a temperature, it seems, in the upper 80s, perhaps. I'm here with Matt Clemens, and we're going to talk a little bit about kayaking. We're also going to be talking about some of his experience, which I believe is vast, involving manatees and other wildlife in the area. How are you doing today, Matt?
I'm doing fine, thank you.
Okay. So the first question is, and how did a nice guy like you get to be in a place like this?
I landed in Florida in 1973 after a stint directly out of high school at the Marquette University, Milwaukee, Wisconsin. And I went from a very small school to a very large university, and I did not adapt very well. I was actually on the way of flunking out after the first semester there. And my grandfather had been the outdoorsman in the family, and he'd done a lot of fishing in the Keys and suggested I might like Florida Keys Community College, and which was just outside of Key West, and it was the early 70s. I thought that was a wonderful idea. Mother didn't think it was quite so wonderful, but so I landed in Key West, and in the early 70s, got a degree in marine biology from Florida Keys Community College. And I taught environmental education in Key West, opened up an environmental center, one of the, at that time it was kind of odd, but Key West was segregated, had segregated schools at the time. And we opened up an environmental center as part of a desegregation program on the University of Miami. And then, again, being the 70s in the Keys, there was really no reason to want to leave when that grant program ran out, so I ran charter boats for a while. First wife was a fourth-generation conch, and after a while, it was time to move on again. And went back to the University of Florida 8 or 9 years later and got a degree in conservation out in the Institute of Food and Agricultural Sciences there, and was in the forestry with a wetlands ecology program. And from there, my boating experience in the Keys got me a job at the university, making sure graduate students didn't sink boats. And then that somehow transitioned into manatee research. I'm still not real sure how that transition occurred, because I was in bass fisheries. And we were doing fisheries research, and I think it was partly because I'd had such a good boating experience, and just the opportunity presented itself. In theory, it was a lot of aerial survey work. And in theory, if you don't get seasick, you don't get airsick, and it turns out not to be the same animal at all. That was in the Fort Myers, Southwest Florida area, so we did manatee research. Had a major red tide outbreak, so mass mortality event. We had to do necropsies, and then we did aerial survey work and studied the Southwest Florida population of manatees for a while. Then a position opened up in Crystal River as an aquatic reserve manager, and so I transitioned into that. Would have been mid-80s, and then worked for the state for about 15 years and decided it was time to move on from there. And then we landed in kayaking.
Okay, well, and in full disclosure, both Lee and I, my wife and I, have taken advantage of the kayaks that are here in Crystal River for 3 years. This will be our third year, and we've had an opportunity to go out and visit what seems to be one of the prime sites for visiting with manatees. Is that correct?
Yeah, that is. There are several sites in Florida where you can see manatees. This particular area has a relatively high concentration in clear water that's outside of a power plant. Traditionally, in the winter months, manatees move to warmer water, which can be power plants, industrial discharges, that kind of thing. But we just happen to have a major spring system here, which is pumping 72-degree water into the bay. So the manatees are drawn to that 72-degree water as the temperatures in the Gulf of Mexico drop. And our population here might peak out at about 700 animals in the coldest parts of the year, under the coldest years.
700 animals in this area. How does that compare with, say, the total population of manatees in the state of Florida?
We're at about 15% of the total population. The four groups of manatees are Northwest Florida, which is our group, then Southwest Florida, East Coast, and then the St. John's River population. And the St. John's River population and Crystal River are the two smallest populations.
Okay. So, you've obviously had a lot of experience with manatees, and even in Alaska, we are aware that manatees have, and you've alluded to at least one event, have suffered some indignities as a population. How are they doing now?
We're at that situation where manatees as a whole, population is probably stable with the potential for a lot of other major events. Last year was a wake-up call. We had 830 manatees died, which is the highest ever on record. So even that, if you figure an overall manatee population, being generous at 5,000 animals, that's way over 10% of the population that we lost in a single year. And that's concerning. Whenever you have marine mammals in particular, it's low reproduction and not a high survival rate. And the most problematic part of that is that at least 200 of those animals, we have no idea why they died. We know the event that led up to it, but we don't know what the actual cause of mortality was. Now, that's very concerning when you're looking at, you know, a large group of manatees and all of a sudden they die and we have no idea. We understand red tide, we understand cold stress. This is a totally new event. And they've excluded morbillivirus and lots of the other things that you would look at for marine mammals. And this is primarily in southeast Florida. Indian River Lagoon is suffering a major environmental collapse. Brown algae bloom shaded out the seagrasses. We lost thousands of acres of seagrass beds, which is a manatee's primary habitat and diet. Manatees adapted and switched their diet to something else, which is not toxic, but yet they're dying in great numbers. You also lost dolphins and pelicans in the same area, but the mortality presents differently. In the case of the dolphins and the pelicans, they're starving to death. They're wasting away, as opposed to manatees, which is a sudden event. They're dying with their mouths full and their stomachs full. And the only thing they have in common is they're in the same water. But as of yet, we don't know why it's happened.
That's very interesting. We have considerable interest in marine life in Alaska. Orca, obviously. Humpback whales. A variety of other creatures. Salmon, because we tend to produce a lot of wild salmon as a product. And so we're very careful at watching and looking, and obviously have had some interesting questions that produce a lot of study. So I'm familiar with that situation where you're not quite sure what's happened, but you know something is happening by observing. Now, we're going to be out kayaking, and we, in preparation for that, watch a very interesting film that details pretty much the do's and don'ts when around manatees. I know that going out and viewing a manatee, whether it's in a tour boat or kayak and swimming by them, is a very attractive proposition for many people. How would you summarize what that pressure brings to bear on manatees? On the one hand, you know, I want people to be able to see the manatee. On the other hand, there are, I would guess, certain pressures that are placed upon them by just having all of that attention.
Yeah, I think you're absolutely right, and I don't think we have a good grip on it. You know, there is such a thing as carrying capacity, and that can be defined in various ways. I mean, you can define it very loosely, saying how many people can you cram into a little springhead and physically cram in. But then there are those more subtleties. Well, how does that affect the manatees trying to use the same springhead? The Endangered Species Act, the Marine Mammal Protection Act, and Manatee Sanctuary Act are all fairly clear, is that, you know, the intent of any activity is to make sure that the manatee's behavior is not altered. And I'm not sure that we can actually say that.
Now, I know that there have been evolving ways to guide people, regulations, if you will. What's upcoming in the near future in terms of making changes in the way manatees are viewed?
I'm not sure what is on the board. We will be having a permit holders meeting with Fish and Wildlife Service next week, and that will kind of give us an indication of any of the new events. Now, we've had some discussions, and they've taken some input on what should be doing. Should we be limiting kayaks and swimmers, or not swimmers and not kayaks? And there has to be some type of combination that's fair to both, but the manatees have got to be the center of that whole conversation. Personally, I favor that in the winter months when the manatees are in Three Sisters, that you use the state's model for Blue Springs State Park. You have varying jurisdictions, but when the government entity owns the entire shoreline, the navigation, the rights to navigation aren't really impacted. In Florida, you have an absolute right, a riparian right to come and go if you're a waterfront property owner. So you'll see that even within the manatee sanctuaries, there are boats within the sanctuary that can move back and forth. They have that right. You can restrict, or the government can restrict other types of activities like fishing and swimming and that kind of stuff within the sanctuary area. But by that same token, you know, the Blue Springs model, because the state owns the entire shoreline of the run, when the manatees come in, all the other activity ceases. And I think that for the Three Sisters area, that's appropriate. It doesn't solve all the problems, because Three Sisters is actually a very small part of Kings Bay. And it is the center of most of the activity because of environmental degradation in other areas of the bay. You end up with a lot of manatees in the clearest water and in an area that's very conducive to the in-the-water viewing because it's very shallow. It's easy to stand on the bottom, even though you're not supposed to do that. You know, from a limited liability from a dive boat perspective, You know, that's one of the safest places to do it.
Okay. So we've had a lot of discussions in Alaska about the effects of climate change. In some respects, we're considered a canary, particularly on our north slope, where we are finding that we're having ice-free conditions much earlier, resulting in all kinds of changes happening. Just in a general way, when we talk about broad changes in climate, not the year-to-year variations that are always with us, but do you notice anything happening? You've had decades here that seem to reflect some bigger changes?
Yeah, we've definitely seen it. In our coastline in particular, you notice lots of dead trees, and that's the end result of sea level rise. That's what it will look like in this particular area. It's actually been going on for quite some time. When I was working the aquatic reserve programs here close to 20 years ago now, we were seeing dead cabbage palm trees and trying to find out what killed the cabbage palms. It really started north of us in the Cedar Key area, Gulf Hammock. And they brought in University of Florida and looked at all the potential viruses and insects and molds and funguses and couldn't really find anything. And then came the realization that when you looked at historic aerial photographs, there used to be oak trees, there used to be pine trees, in these same areas are now seeing dead cabbage palms. So what we're really seeing is the last man standing. And when the last man is standing, it becomes a whole lot more visible. And then, so it was been going for some time. Within the last 5 to 10 years, it's been a definite acceleration in our immediate coastal area, the Azolo area, especially along the Azolo Trail. You know, there's definitely been an acceleration, and we're losing a lot more of it out there.
I've seen one map that suggests, projecting into the future, that Florida may become a very small state.
Yeah, I may have our properties 20 miles from here. But that's entirely possible, and unfortunately, in most areas of Florida, it's not on the radar. You know, it is in the Keys, because the Keys will be ground zero. So Miami-Dade, Monroe, you know, they're a lot farther ahead than most of the rest of the state is here. Now, locally, there has been essentially no discussion other than about flood insurance rates and, you know, how that all plays out. But in terms of actual mitigation for any of it, there has been no real attempt to, you know, keep people out of the area that's going to be impacted. That's one of the reasons I have not bought property in downtown Crystal River. You know, when the city was first developed, they cut drainage ditches, and the idea was is that when it rained, the water would run off into the bay.
Right.
Well, with sea level rise, now the water runs the other direction. So you get especially high tides and heavy rainfall, you know, have a whole lot more flooding now than we did before.
We've been focused on manatees here, Mike Molesky talking with Matt Clemens in Crystal River, Florida, but there are other creatures around here, both in the sea and nearby. Would you talk a little bit about other wildlife?
Well, the Citrus County, this area is known as the Nature Coast, and there's excellent birding. There are several very hot spots for birding, but just generally overall, especially the coastline, because it's shallow water grass flats. As the migrations come through, the numbers of birds increase dramatically. We have several species that come in that are highly viewable, white pelicans in particular. They come in pretty much strictly in the winter months, although they do seem to be arriving a little bit early this year. Normally it's a week or so after Thanksgiving, but we're already seeing birds that are staying in the county. But the whole gamut of wading birds, the one thing that we have lost over the years is waterfall. And that's just a phenomenon that has happened all over. It's known as short-stopping. The birds no longer complete full migrations because they're finding food in open water in areas north of the southern end of the migration route. So you don't see the full complement of the migratory waterfall that we used to see.
Okay, and we're very familiar, again, in Alaska, with migration patterns, particularly in the spring and fall. We have crane and duck and geese and all the rest just filling the sky. Well, I came across something this morning. We were on a walk just north of Crystal River in an echo area, and we saw some marks in the ground and first wondered what they were. I think we decided armadillo, looking for ants, because they were very curious. At first it looked as if we had some hoofed creature that was there in the soft ground. It was definitely marks. And then we came up with that. Well, given that brief description, are there armadillo here in this area?
Yes, there are armadillos here. The other thing that will do that, but to a much greater extent in terms of ground damage, is hogs. Florida is overrun with feral pigs. they blame the Spanish in the 1500s because that's how they arrived in Florida. Up until that time, there were no ancestral hogs in Florida.
Okay, so unless we took you out there and looked carefully, armadillo or pig, hunting for feral pigs?
There is hunting in different areas. There are a number of different agencies that manage lands in Florida. Florida Department of Environmental Protection typically does parks and preserves, and those are usually no-hunt areas. There are some special exemptions for certain programs that they do. Then you have the Florida Fish and Wildlife Conservation Commission. Their lands are primarily hunting lands, so you would have hog season in, as part of the regular program there. Then you have the water management districts in an area where it's called the Southwest Florida Water Management District. And they, again, manage preserves and water conservation lands, and they typically will have special hunts in conjunction with the Wildlife Commission in order just to control the damage being done from feral hogs.
Okay. Well, I think we've just about finished up with the time we have here. Matt, is there anything that we have not covered that you'd like to say before we end the interview?
If I could say one thing about wildlife in Florida, we don't have, in the case of the manatees, we're not talking about grizzly bears. You know, you don't have to carry a .45 to protect yourself when you're in the wilderness area. But treat them with respect. You know, treat them as wild animals. Don't treat them as house pets.
Okay.
And everybody will be better off.
All right. Well, in some respects, I look upon this area of Florida as Alaska South. There's a similarity in many respects. It's not a heavily populated area. There's certainly access both in the water and in land to some very interesting areas. And I want to thank Matt Clemens for taking the time to share some of his experience.
You're more than welcome. Thank you very much.